This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good afternoon. This is Feminist Fridays on The Bigger Picture, and I'm Juliet Jacobs. Stella Paul is an award-winning independent multimedia journalist who shares stories of those who have been silenced. She has worked to give a voice to survivors of sexual violence and assault, sex workers, and many other marginalized communities in India. She joins me now over the line from India to discuss her award-winning reporting and coverage on the connections between gender and climate change, why she believes women are bearing the brunt of the effects of climate change, and also how she has been fighting for honesty and integrity in journalism. Welcome, Stella. How are you today?
I'm good. Thank you. Glad to be here.
Thank you so much for joining us. So, Stella, I was reading that as a journalist, you report the issues that you personally have lived through and that you're using a unique perspective from living in refugee camps and shelters. Could you tell me a little bit about your early years?
Yes, I grew up in the province that borders Myanmar and Bangladesh and China. Mm-hmm. And this is even today considered one of the remotest provinces in India. And growing up, our houses would be flooded every year. Mm-hmm. And every year for at least for a few weeks, we would be shifting to a school or sometimes just on the open bank of the river. Mm-hmm. And that's where we used to live. We'd be getting a food packet dropped by the army helicopters, which is continuing even today in some places.
Yes.
And it used to be extremely traumatic, although at that time I didn't really know about these issues like trauma and not even those terms, but I remember it used to be a very, very big and difficult struggle for my mother to take care of us four children. Wow. And my grandmother and a few other people who often would come to live with us, their relatives, and to live, go through these disasters year after year after year. Those were the memories that I grew up with. Mm-hmm. And the other memories would be also, you know, that place used to have a lot of political conflict. Right. So we often had curfews, a blackout where you were not allowed to switch on the light in the house. So on one hand, we had political conflict and security issues, and then on the other hand, we had the insecurity that is induced by climate and extreme weather. And I guess those are the incidents that kind of made me who I am today and also brought me where I am today. But the memories are not really nice. Nonetheless, I have learned and grown to draw my strength from them.
And I guess maybe that's why also you want to give a voice to the voiceless, because I suppose there was not much coverage as such, you know, from the media on the kind of experiences that you were living, that you yourself were experiencing.
Absolutely. Actually, just a few weeks ago, my house, which has been flooded and broken many times in the past, was flooded yet again. And the entire community was actually living on the roof of their houses. And today, standing where we are now in this age of, you know, internet and multiple TV news channels, that news was not covered by the national media at all. So you can imagine how the things were back then, you know, 15, 20, 25 years ago. So as I grew up, I grew more conscious of seeing how my entire community, including me, was totally, invisible when it comes to the national picture, let alone the global picture. And as I decided to, you know, become a storyteller, these are the people and these are the events and stories that obviously I was surrounded by. And I thought that I could be the one to start this.
That's amazing, you know. I mean, because how long did you live in that sort of situation? Was it all throughout your growing up years?
all throughout my growing up years.
Wow, you're amazing.
Until I went to college.
Wow. And you mentioned your mother and your siblings and your grandmother, and all of you just, you know, lived together and just made your way through life like that.
Yes. And so did my neighbors and my cousins and my extended family of relatives. We lived in a situation where we thought that was how life was to be.
Right.
Until I grew up and I went to university and I saw life beyond my community. And I came to realize that, no, that's not how life has to be. And the good thing was that I realized that maybe I could play a role in, you know, in a very small way to tell people that this is not how people need to live on for all their lives.
And I just want to talk a little bit about your work in climate change, specifically and environmental journalism. I mean, what is it that inspired you to focus on that aspect of, you know, reporting as such?
So, as you know, when we talk to people living in the lower strata of society, people who are right in the middle of climate change, they don't really know these big terms, you know, the climate change or extreme weather or the scientific terms that we otherwise deal with. Mm. For them, it's very simple. It's very directly, you know, attached to their livelihood and their living. So it's like either you lose your crop, the crop failure, or there is no water and your cattle dies, and then you are forced to sell off your entire year's food grain for a very nominal price because you don't know how to store them as your house is destroyed.
Right.
So this was pretty much the case of mine and my family as well. We were not consciously aware of terms like climate change. But then again, the food, the water crisis, the crisis of drinking water or sanitation, you know, those were the issues that surrounded us every day, day in and day out. So when I grew up and I felt like I started as a political news reporter, mm-hmm. but after a few months, I realized that there were other stories that are considered not so such a priority, but those are the real issues that actually concern a lot of people, millions of people in my country as well as elsewhere. And that's how, you know, unconsciously I was living the climate issues, but now I begin to see them in a more, you know, conscious way, and I started to talk about them and then to write about them.
Right. And I think it's interesting, you know, we use climate change like, you know, like nothing, but, you know, it's not necessarily an understood threat as such, you know, it's just a lived reality for, you know, for the farmers, like you were mentioning, for the people that you knew. I guess, you know, people don't even understand the science behind it. They're just facing the realities of it.
They do, actually. So if I can just walk you to the northeastern India, mm-hmm. the province that I said borders Myanmar and Bangladesh, mm-hmm. And China, you know, that's the mountain province. It has multiple mountain rivers. So many of these rivers are cross-boundary rivers.
Okay.
Some of them origin in India, in China, and they flow all the way through India and then to Bangladesh.
Okay.
So when dams are built, let's say in China, and the water is released, you know,
mm-hmm.
it's actually flooding a huge swath of land across India and in Bangladesh. People have no idea that this is kind of man-made, you know.
Right.
That is a result of the management of resources by a certain country or a certain government. They just think that there's too much of rain and too much of water suddenly come.
Right.
So I think that as journalists, as people who are a little more aware of the situation, we it's both our duties and our opportunity to educate people, to let people know that, no, this is not really the rain. This is also about people managing, you know, certain, water body or certain land. Like I said, it's an opportunity. It's also a duty, and that's how I started out. And yes, climate change is not something that you know, per se, people living, very, very common people don't really talk about climate change, but they do notice that there are certain change in the pattern, the way the weather used to be back then and the weather is right now.
I'm speaking today to Stella Paul. She's an independent multimedia journalist, and we're talking about her work in reporting, well, giving voice to those who are voiceless, and, you know, how she reports on how women are bearing the brunt of climate change. And after this quick break, we're going to find out about her award-winning piece on Maharashtra that's coming up after this quick break. You are listening to Feminist Fridays on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9. Good afternoon. This is Feminist Fridays on The Bigger Picture, and I'm Juliet Jacobs. Joining me on the line from India today is Stella Paul. She's an independent multimedia journalist, and we're discussing her work in drawing the connection between climate change and how women are more adversely, affected by its effects. Stella, you drew the connections between gender and climate change, and I think it was in Hyderabad and also in Maharashtra. These are the areas that you went to visit. I mean, many more areas as well. But tell me, what first got you, you know, interested in drawing that connection and making that connection known to people?
So I live in Hyderabad, and I was reading a newspaper. This was in late 2012. It was a report by the government that shows that in certain pockets, the number of HIV-positive people had suddenly increased in a very alarming way.
Okay.
And then they also said that in the same pockets, the number of commercial sex workers had also increased.
Okay.
And this was a big jump, like about 15 to 20% of sudden jump.
Mm-hmm.
So I started to, I was very curious, like, why, and Hyderabad was one of the places where the biggest jump had been, noticed. And I was very curious to know what could be the possible connection. And we also knew that Hyderabad, along with Maharashtra, these are the two of the other many states where a lot, thousands and thousands of farmers have committed suicide.
Right.
Because of crop failure,
right,
in past few years, and it's continuing even today. So I was, our media had very extensively, regularly reporting on the farm deaths, but I was curious to know if there was a connection between the crop failure and the farmer's death and this jump in the commercial sex workers. And so I contacted a few organizations who work on AIDS and HIV people issues,
mm-hmm,
and also with those who work with the commercial sex workers. And after about 2 months research, I found out that 69% of women who had joined the sex industry in Hyderabad and in Maharashtra and elsewhere in past 5 years, mm-hmm, had from families where there had been at least one suicide, okay, because of, the drought.
Right.
And so I was shocked because there is this huge number of women who are coming from rural families where their father or their husband committed suicide, leaving them totally alone and helpless. And they had forced to travel to the nearest city to find a livelihood. And because they didn't have any qualification or any document, they ended up in the sex industry. All of them were actually forced.
Right.
And this was such a huge tragedy, but it was not in the media at all. So the media had collectively missed one of the biggest tragedies that had been affecting so many of our women. And that's how I decided that I could do this story, that there is a certain connection, a definite connection between drought and climate change, mm-hmm, and trafficking or, the labor abuse of people, women. After about 3.5 months of work, the story was out. And I was very glad that the story did receive a huge response, And more than that, the women who were, and most of the women that had, I had featured in my story, received direct or indirect help, and they were rehabilitated.
Oh, that's wonderful.
Yes.
And maybe you can tell me a little bit about those women, you know, I mean, maybe one of the stories that, you know, really stood out for you, one of the women that you spoke to, because you traveled all across India, Nepal, Bhutan, even Pakistan, speaking to those who have, I guess, not only suffered from crop failure, but lack of water. And I mean, what were some of the stories that really moved you?
The stories that initially moved me are where women, you know, irrespective of where they have come from and what they have gone through, they are always looking forward, and they're ready for something, a training opportunity or an opportunity to tell their own stories or to build new connections or to be part of a network. You know, women, I think they have tremendous hope and courage in their heart. Mm-hmm. They're always looking for something, some constructive way that they can turn around their lives and the lives of their children. And I think as an individual, as well as a journalist, these stories and covering these women actually also give me a lot of inspiration to go on and do something, you know, more than or outside of the box. I'll tell you a story of a woman that I actually just met. This woman comes from one of the, again, from Maharashtra, and one of the regions that has seen a lot of extreme weathers, as well as a lot of political conflicts. And she is in her mid-50s. Her name is Kumari Bai. Mm-hmm. And a week ago, I trained her. So after, you know, my initial years of reporting, I decided that since women, they are always asking for something. They're looking for something, not just an aid package, but they want a cell phone or a networking opportunity, something. So I decided that why don't I start giving them, you know, training them into digital media or in a way that they can tell their own story. And so I started connecting them with the women's network that I'm part of, mm-hmm. and it's called World Pulse. Mm-hmm. And it is now, it exists in 190 countries. Okay. And it gives women a chance to come and tell their own story.
Wow.
Yes. So I became a digital empowerment trainer by training women into, you know, basic internet and social media using whatever technology they have in their hand. You know, whether it's a cell phone or it's a tablet, very few have tablets, most of them have cell phones, or it's just a cyber cafe in their area. So I train them into how to use these existing resources to come and tell their own story and find new connections and build network, start a new project, ask for fund and raise fund.
Wow, so that's amazing.
She comes from this place called Gadchiroli. As a county, it comes within an area that the government has recognized as a conflict zone.
Okay.
And I trained her, and in 3 days, she learned to use social media, and you know, she opened up an account in this group called World Pulse, and she made a video, and she learned digital storytelling, the very basic part of it. But I'm going to go for a second round of training. And I was so impressed by her enthusiasm. She is so old, you know, and comes from this very remote, hard-to-reach place. And here she was learning digital storytelling using her cell phone.
Amazing.
You know, that was actually.
And I mean, that's something that you've spoken about also, right? That women don't have the knowledge about using technology, and that has, you know, also led them to you know, having to go into sex work, for example, once their husbands have passed away, or their fathers or whoever, because, you know, with gendered roles, you know, programmed, I suppose, the way it is, they ultimately are just raised to be mothers and wives and not taught how to actually you know, survive or skills as such, knowledge, those sorts of knowledge.
Absolutely. You know, women are from the rural areas and the marginalized, as well as the indigenous communities all over the world, they have not just a lot of courage and strength of body and heart, but they have this tremendous amount of wisdom, you know, mm-hmm. and a lot of traditional knowledge. So given a chance, you know, access to digital technologies, one of them, and some customized opportunities, they can really change the entire picture for them. But often this linkage, this component is missing. So what happens is, as long as their father or, you know, the male guardians of the families are there, they enjoy most of the skill building or the capacity building opportunities that government, you know, offer to farming families. Right. And when they're gone, the women are actually, they don't have any particular skill. And you just mentioned digital technology. So let's say now almost every house in India has a cell phone, a mobile phone. But often we see that it's the male guardians who actually use them, and the women are not given direct access to those gadgets. So if only they were given proper and regular access to a cell phone, they could actually learn how to use it for situations, you know, where there's a crisis or where there is an emergency. They would probably be able to then contact an organization, you know, before, when they were being sex trafficked or they are just being promised a job and then forced into, into commercial sex work, as an example.
Right.
So yes, if little measures of giving women greater access to digital technology, or to any kind of technology that exists in their community already, could really help them a lot in mitigating or in dealing with a crisis situation.
Okay, and I just want to talk a little bit about your work in reporting at the Conference of Parties negotiations. I remember reading about, you know, even at COP21, you said that there was an urgent need for the media to report on gender issues, specifically from the COPs. Maybe you can tell me a little bit about, you know, your efforts to make gender a focus throughout those many different conferences.
Yeah, so I actually started to cover the COP since in 2011. Mm-hmm. And the very first year, I remember meeting a few young women who had traveled all the way from East Africa to the Southern Africa in Durban of South Africa, where the COP was taking place.
Yeah.
And they had been traveling for weeks in a bus, had very basic sitting arrangement. There was nothing very luxurious about the bus. It broke down so many times along the way. And these women, they were all young women in their mid-20s, and they came from different backgrounds. And, you know, along the way that they traveled to this COP just to tell their stories, they had also seen how river after river after river along the way were all dry and the communities were suffering, and they had stopped actually along the way to interact with farmers there. So they had a bouquet of, you know, tremendously interesting stories, ground stories. And, you know, I was so surprised to see that not a single journalist was interested in communicating with these women. Nobody was talking to them. Hmm. Nobody was asking them how their experiences were, what they were doing at this COP. So the COP, as we know, is essentially a place where all the countries come together to formulate, you know, new law and find out the new legal nitty-gritties, you know. So that, and the negotiate, of course. But that apart, there are people, you know, all these laws and all these negotiations, they're ultimately for the people. And here we had a community of people, women, you know, and nobody was actually looking at them. And that was really shocking to me, you know. And then I came to know that gender was really back then until 2011, actually until 2012, the COP that happened in Qatar, Doha. Gender was just not an issue there, was not priority at all. So, but after Doha, gender issue started to, you know, Mary Robinson, the former president, prime minister of Ireland, was specially brought into the UN FCCC by the secretary, UN Secretary General, to look after or to bring in gender issue and draw more attention to it. So I have been off and on since then, going to the COPs and reporting to the COPs. But in most cases, I still find that, you know, it remains one of the, you know, the checklist. Like, have you covered this? Have we covered that? Have we also covered gender? Yes, check. even now, I mean, last 2 years, I was very happy to see that, you know, some organizations had been talking, some reporting, the media houses had been actually asking for more gender stories coming out of the COPs, like how far have we progressed? Have the women's demand been met with? But again, it goes up and it comes down. I could find myself fighting with everybody to include include women, gender in their agenda. And yeah, it's like you have to keep constantly hammering, you know.
No, that's why we must always keep the conversation going and, you know, make that connection known to people because, you know, I guess when it comes to climate change, there's always the talk about poor versus, you know, not so poor, but they don't really take into account the gender conversation in all of that.
Yes, actually, you know, it used to be this poor versus not so poor, but as, you know, the happenings around the world have shown us, in past, if you just look at the past 2 years, mm-hmm. we have seen, cities like New York has had terrible blizzards and, snowstorms. We have seen flooding in some of the world's, a city like Bangkok has had flooding. We have seen so many, rich and well-managed and, cities that we thought were very sustainable, they had terrible flooding. So this, and when flooding happens, you know, or disaster strikes a city, it's not really, it strikes everybody equally. So it's not just, you know, like the women living in a certain rural belt, but also women like you and me who work, who go to work, are suffering because the whole road is flooded. You know, the transportation system, the subway system is halted. It's actually, it affects everybody. And yet, I would say that probably rural women's voices get more attention than urban women's voices when it comes to climate change. We don't hear these stories, you know, how a working mother of 2 or 3 kids is managing when there is a tremendous water shortage in the city or when there is heavy rain or downpour or a cyclone.
But how do you think we can frame women as, you know, as agents of change, you know, beyond merely as a vulnerable group as such, you know, in both adaptation and mitigation to climate change?
I think you kind of answered your question that I heard the answer. That, you know, it has been a long, long tendency for all of us, you know, to look at climate change, people in the middle of fighting the climate change as victims, mm-hmm. and less as, as winners or heroes. So I think that, everybody is a victim here, but nonetheless, there are a large number of women, both in the urban setting and in the rural setting, who have been fighting the climate change in its different form. You know, whether it's in water shortage, whether it's in land, you know, drought or floods or storms, women have been there in the front line of climate change, and they have been fighting it in different ways. They are mobilizing other people, they are safeguarding them, they are fighting for their rights to get insurance, disaster insurance, or they are fighting to get them right packages from the government, or just to, you know, reach, you know, articulate their recommendations and their what works for them and taking it to the government. So there are women working in every possible capacity, in every possible setting, fighting climate change and already trying to find ways to, you know, adapt mm-hmm. as well as mitigate. We just need to go and bring these stories up, and we need to bring forth women's leadership, because as we, you know, as we see, that is one thing that almost missing all the time. Women as climate leader yeah. is hardly ever noticed and reported or spoken.
Okay. And I guess the other thing that I wanted to find out from you was, you know, what kind of responses do your stories on, you know, especially women and climate change and all these difficult topics that you're discussing, you know, what sort of reactions do you get generally, or responses do you get?
Yeah, I'm very happy to have seen the kind of impacts and the reactions that have come in after I have reported a certain story. For example, the story that we just discussed, where, you know, women from farming families had been forced into sex work. That story had a huge number of impacts. I saw there were men, actually businessmen, who came forward and they were offering jobs for these women into solar equipment making factories. There were people who came forward to say that they wanted to raise funds for these women. So starting from there, I have seen reactions of readers who gathered, who grouped together to release women from rural belts who were brought into the cities and forced into slavery, mm-hmm. unpaid slavery. They got them released.
Wow.
And then there have been universities like the University of Columbia. Columbia University, they came to me and a host of other organizations, including UN agencies, who came to me and said that we are about to make a list of recommendations for the countries to make things more environment friendly for women and to help them fight climate change in a better way. So we would like you to come and, you know, share your opinions. So, and then the very interesting other reactions that I get are from women from other villages who hear that a certain woman from their community was actually interviewed and she was able to tell their story, or she was able to get some training into storytelling. They come to me and they say, we would like you to come to our village and train us. We would like you to come and see what kind of work we are doing and help us tell our own stories. So in one such event in Maharashtra, there was a group of, actually a city that had been having a tremendous drinking water shortage, decided to renovate a lake that had gone all dry. So they decided to dig it up again and renovate it. So it's like community-led participatory movement where they didn't want to depend on the city or the government anymore. So they pulled in money and, you know, they donated labor to renovate this lake completely. And that was such an inspiring reaction for me to witness, where the entire community got inspired by a single story and decided to, you know, start acting on their own.
That's a wonderful, I mean, you know, seeing that direct impact of just something that you felt strongly about, but the kind of reactions and the kind of, I guess, effects it had. That's really what it's all about, isn't it?
It is, totally. And as a journalist, you know, who tells people's stories, and especially stories of those who are usually left behind. Mm-hmm. You know, this is very gratifying to see that that in my own way, I'm able to make some constructive, bring in some constructive impact, and probably create something good.
Okay, and as you mentioned earlier, you're now the lead ambassador for World Pulse, so you're actually teaching women how to use technology. You were talking about that. What else are you working on next?
Besides, you know, training women into digital technology, I also mentor a large number of women, mostly in South Asia and Africa, who have been the direct survivor of gender-based violence, including breast ironing and female genital mutilation, and also dowry beating and acid attacks.
Okay.
So I have been mentoring them, and there's this plan where I'm going to train these women. I also train them into public speaking and just how to go and, you know, tell their stories or report on their communities, you know, at larger global forums. So that's a project that I'm about to take up. So this is all that runs in parallel to my storytelling. I do report, and then I also go one step ahead and train these women into something that they can, you know, use to improve their own life.
Okay. All right. And we wish you all the luck. You know, you're award-winning journalist, so many to your credit, and just you know, wonderful work that you're doing. So it's such an amazing person you are.
Thank you. Thank you. And thank you so much for letting me have a chance to speak with you and to your audience. This is amazing to be able to tell the stories of these women, you know, who are not always very well heard. So thank you.
And you also have a website, yes, stellapaul.com, where we can, I guess, follow your musings and all of that?
Yes. I have a website. This was twice, actually, they won the Best Blogs in Asia Award.
Wow.
But then journalism took up a larger time of mine. But I have made a comeback this year, so I have started to write again.
Okay, and you're also on Twitter and any other forms of social media that we can follow you on?
Yes, you can follow me on Twitter, and then I'm on Facebook and on LinkedIn and in Instagram, and my one-stop ID is Stella's Globe.
Stella's Globe, so that's Stella's Globe, right?
Yes.
Okay, all right. Thank you so much for joining me today, Stella.
You're welcome, and totally very, very glad to be here.
I've been speaking to Stella Paul. She's an independent multimedia journalist, and we were talking about her work in reporting about the linkages between women bearing the brunt of climate change, and, you know, how Stella herself is actually training these women to tell their own stories, you know, how they can adapt to technology and so much more. That website, again, if you'd like to follow Stella, is stellapaul.com, and you can follow her on Twitter, Instagram, you know, Facebook, and everything else. If you miss any part of this interview or any previous Feminist Friday's interviews, you can search for the podcasts on our BFM app, available on Google Play and the App Store. This has been Feminist Friday's On the Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.